Well, how did knowing that, you know, the work you did contributed to winning or being granted the Nobel Prize, it changed the kind of the own, your attitudes of the or your own expectations on the kind of quality and quantity of the work you could do, you were capable of doing?
Well, I don't think that the actual awarding of that prize changed my perspective on what I could do. I had already kind of established my own set of goals as what I could do, and that those weren't or my productivity level, and I don't think that that was changed by just the awarding of the Nobel Prize to people I formerly worked with.
Yeah. Well, did it change in terms of other people's lives? Do you think it changed your work?
Oh, absolutely. it opened doors for me here. It's still opening doors. Doors that I can't... It opened the pew door. And that was a hard door to walk through. I'm not sure I'm all the way through it either. But there's... So, yeah, there's no question it's still opening doors.
So do you think you are capable of doing kind of Nobel Prize attention-garnering work?
Yes, I do. Attention-garnering work. I don't think I'm capable of doing Nobel Prize-awarding work that requires a lot more skill and discipline and time than I've got left, so to speak, or whatever. In contact, but that doesn't bother me either. I think that I am making contributions, and I wish it was a little less painful at time, though. But I'm enjoying it for the most part. I touched on that a little bit, and I'll maybe talk about it a little bit more right now. That in some ways, that's been hard for me to live up to other people's expectations because I worked with Joe and Mike for so long and was more or less from the start all the way through that. As I said, that it's open doors, still continue to open doors that I don't feel comfortable about entering. It's not that I don't want to go in there, but if you go in that room, there's some responsibilities and some expectations that it's difficult to meet. So just because the door is open doesn't mean you always should walk in there, but. You never know what's in there if you don't have that opportunity to look in. So that's being associated with them has given me the opportunity to at least look inside and go in occasionally. But I'm limiting the amount of doors that I'm walking through now.
Why is that?
Because I can't meet the expectations and the responsibilities that come with being in those rooms. And, you know, quite frankly, the pew was a pretty heady room. And I was not always, and we talked about this, I think, yesterday. Oh, perhaps it was off the record, but I didn't feel all that comfortable all the time, even in Cozumel on the sunny beaches. So I think other people might react and respond differently and welcome the opportunity for that, for these sort of challenges. I've got a pretty good grasp of my limitations, and my limitations limit me from doing some of the things that are available.
And what are your limitations?
Well, scientifically, I kind of once again, if you think about if you think about the contributions that Joe and Mike made from defining a disease that was caused by an inherited single gene, all the way to where we are now, and to picking apart cholesterol regulation at the cellular level, then it has followed a discrete and linear progression. You make an observation, and you ask the next relevant question. And then you answer that question, and then that leads to the next logical question along the line. And productive science follows that same logical step-by-step process. But I've kind of gotten out of that mode of doing science and become more fragmented in going off on tangents, I guess, and trying to just satisfy my curiosity about anything that looks like it's unique and answerable, hopefully, in biology, rather than follow logical progressions. So fragmentation, I think, is a weak point now. I'm trying to get back into a mode. I mean, if you look at my CV, you can see that there's a lot of different. I got off on a lot of other, although they kind of related to cholesterol metabolism or whatever, although I'm not really dealing with cholesterol metabolism now, but these tangential projects. And part of that was just I wouldn't be in competition with them. They could do things on my own because I want to stay away from that. But the other part is that they just held my interest longer. So I need to come back into that. And then secondly, I don't have the discipline that I think it takes to budget, to allocate time, and to be firm in the commitment that you apply to any kind of project, whether it's in the office or in the lab or whatever. I just kind of lost this discipline that I used to have to get things done. And that's something I'm really groping with these days. It just seems like it takes forever to accomplish really simple tasks on a day-to-day basis, like writing a letter or organizing a lecture. I'm really struggling with that right now. And I think it's just, you know, from, as I pointed out, from lack of discipline, just sitting down and doing it. You know, said, okay, I'm going to write letters from, you know, 8 to 9:30 or whatever, and if I don't get it done, then forget it. And I didn't think I'd ever lose that, you know, because that was something I picked up from athletics, is to, you know, from the constant drills and understanding that and performing repetitive things that was important to be disciplined. Because when the time came to do something important, then you would have the capability and the, you know, the internal fortitude or whatever it takes to do that. So, struggling with that.
Well, does that mean one must a scientist to be productive and constantly making discoveries and innovations all the time, have to lead a somewhat cloistered life, and that there's science and pretty much nothing else? Or can as a scientist, you know, have? I guess what I'm asking is, what does this say about science? Is when, you know, a person must maintain kind of rigid disciplines over their activities in order to be successful? Or
well, I think that's true in science and probably true in a lot of other fields, that those individuals who are disciplined in their in the time they spend at tasks and getting things done and as efficiently as possible, be it mundane chores so that they could relieve time to focus attention on the really important things, whether like in an experiment. So for me, it's mundane things would be writing a letter or reviewing a manuscript or whatever, so I could get back into the more important things, which would be the lab. That I think that those of us in the profession who are highly disciplined are stand greater likelihood of being successful than those of us who aren't. Just like that in the funding environment that we're in, not only financial environment, but also the attitude of study sections, this logical progression along a experimental, the logical progression through an experimental tack is the way to go, rather than freelancing observations. I think that time is something of the past. You know, that you could just get an idea and then run off and start a small project and make an observation and publish a paper. That's not going to get funding. I don't care if it is does become Nobel Prize award-winning experiments. It's just not going to survive in the thinking of study sections these days. Now, I guess if you don't have to rely upon study sections for funding, then that's okay. But really, to be successful in funding, you have to accomplish the goals that you tell the study section in the previous granting period that you were going to do, because they're going to look at that old grant and say, well, here you said that you were going to clone A, you were going to make an antibody against B, and then you were going to overexpress C. So 3 years later, they're going to say, so what happened when you cloned A? What did you use the B antibody for? And it used to be that as long as if you said you were going to do A, B, and C, but 3 years later, if you didn't do A, B, and C, but you had six other publications on something else related, then that's okay. But I don't think that's true these days.
Mm. Well, again, I'll ask what is in a different way. What right. does that mean for science? Because you have taken an unorthodox approach to at least career in science, and yet you've come up with incredible contributions to scientific canon. And what happens to science when, you know, you can't take unorthodox approaches and freelance and do, you know, phenomenal work, but must take a safe route?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that could, number one, it could eliminate some of the people that potentially can be successful in this profession, because they're just going to realize, like I do, that fragmented science is not going to lead to funding. So, number one, either they'll drop out, or number two, they'll struggle along and not be successful. But those creative, fragmented people won't have the support to potentially make really important observations. Now, that's not saying the observations won't get made, because clearly they'll probably get made. And it won't say that they're not that they won't get made any later in time. They may get made. They may come about in literature at about the same speed, but they'll come from this other process rather than freelancing. So it's more of it limits the arena in which science is done, and perhaps also limits those individuals who will do it. And that's about all I can say about it. I don't know that it says it will limit the amount of observations that we make or that the time that they come forth. It's sure a lot boring, though. It is for me, you know. And you can see it in people I know. There, oftentimes you can really capture, you can see imagination in colleagues' faces by talking about something that's new and exciting and unique, not connected with their field. You know, and you can read in their mind, or you can see in their mind that they would like to be able to do something in this field to be part of it. But, you know, they are in step to another dance. And the pew is wonderful in allowing, in their lack of strings associated with their money, that they can allow people like me to to be fragmented and contribute to my demise, more or less. So, and potentially, and that's great, because it, I think the pew is saying that we realize that there's a certain amount of knowledge that comes from just pure creativity, and oftentimes just the pursuit of something that's not exactly part of a logical progression, and that there have been important discoveries made in a more freelance style, and it's important to contribute to that thinking and to give investigators the opportunity to do one or two extra experiments to potentially come up with something really big that could open up whole new areas of thought and experimentation. So we want to support this, and that's great. So there is effort by agencies like the Pew Charitable Trust to keep that up.
Well, do you think your talents and abilities and productivity would be better cultivated and utilized in a different environment, in a world in which, you know, fragmented science can be funded, or in ways in which, you know, funding doesn't come from study sections?
Well, I think I'd probably function better, but I'm probably in the minority, and it's probably a good thing that most of the funding that goes to people, the majority of them, should be focused on or directed towards the majority's way of doing science.
And what is it about you that makes you function better in, a, you know, in this, by doing, say, taking an unorthodox approaches to topics and fields?
I don't know. I don't know, maybe it's just a different sort of curiosity. I mean, certainly I could see that you could take a lot of personal satisfaction in setting goals, specific aims, and then accomplishing those as you go along, because there's something you can point to and say, this is what I said I was going to do, and this is what I did. But to me, it's just as rewarding to kind of wander around and get an idea and think of a way to address that idea and do it and then move on. Sounds like another example of undisciplined actions.
Well, why do you think Goldstein supported Perot, or was it Brown that made a kind of a public announcement of Perot?
Well, number one, I wasn't there, so I'm not sure this is all hearsay.
Yeah, okay.
I guess if he did, he felt that he was the best presidential candidate at the time. I really never knew much about them personally. We didn't socialize. We had at all. There was a holiday party every year, and oftentimes it was over at Mike's house, and that's the only time I ever went to their house. So I don't know his political views.
Mm-hmm.
Our relationship was about 90% professional. You know, I know even less about Joe. So. I don't know why Mike would say that, unless I can only assume that he thought that he was the best presidential candidate at the time.
Well, do you think the way the Pew funds science, or perhaps Perot's kind of solution to funding science, or even, you know, presidential campaigns, is to pour money in certain directions? May be the better way than to have, study sections, federally funded granting agencies through funding sections that decide who gets what. I guess what I'm leading to is how do you think we can structure science funding, scientific funding or support for science, in a way that will, allow kind of creative people to do creative things.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we're doing a pretty good job of it now. Because there are things like the Hughes and Perot and then other benefactors similar to Perot, perhaps not at that level, that will recognize individuals that have a greater opportunity to really move forward and to move back the frontiers of ignorance and to move forward in science. And so it's a better bet to place money in these people's hands and get reward, and for society to get rewards, than it would be just based on, once again, their past performance and credentials. That these people are a better bet to do that than others in our profession. So I think Perot does a good thing by giving a lot of money to Joe and Mike for their operation, and then also giving money to, say, Southwestern Medical School to try to continue to have a constant supply of potentially creative people, or people who might fit into this category that we would want to more or less give money to freely. That has to kind of be in the works. We just can't stop. And at the same time, the rest of us will make contributions, but we're not easily identifiable with this initial group. So, and because the majority of us will fall into that category, and then there's only a limited amount of money there, too, that there needs to be a way to give that out on a fair, equitable basis. And, by following directions from a study section is as good as anything, I think. Because these are art-skilled people in each individual field who have knowledge about accomplishing the specific aims that are being proposed and can look and see if the investigator has a certain amount of track record and credentials to do this. So I guess what I'm saying is that, yes, there should be a balance between, more or less no strings attached money and strings attached money, and we're probably doing a good job of it. where there could be room for improvement, I think, is that in the number of in the amount of money that's available to each of these categories, and then perhaps in the number of investigators in the latter category, that we would be more efficient if we had, say, more money available for everybody, and then also more efficient at spending that money if we weren't giving it to some projects that were not as feasible, or the investigators were less likely to get a return on it. But I guess that's something that's come about through our... So I guess what I'm saying is I think we have too many of us out there working now in laboratories and applying for grants, and that's come about because there were too many PhDs coming out, too many postdocs to follow that. So, and that came out at a time when NIH funding was very, very high, and we just didn't see the downside of that when NIH funding got very, very low. But now it's back up again, so whatever. But I think unquestionably there's too many independent researchers vying for a great deal of money, but when you have to divide it up among so many laboratories, and it limits what each laboratory can do. But with the Browns and the Goldsteins and the Hughes investigators and the Perot's fundings, and I think, you know, that's a pretty good arrangement. I mean, those people are, we have two Hughes investigators on this campus, and they're the best investigators that we have. There's no question about it. And there's a great opportunity for Ralph Isberg to make considerable contributions to understanding cell biology on a prokaryotic level.
Well, given your own experiences at the different kind of levels of hierarchy and or different hierarchy spots you've had within the laboratory, is there a better way to organize this chain of command? You mentioned that, as a research associate in a relatively small lab, you had some independence. And then by the time you left, postdocs were being attracted just for the kinds of skills that they could bring into the lab. So it shifted from bringing technicians in as contributing to skills to postdocs, not even graduate students, but postdocs with these kind of skills to contribute. So how do you see, you know, can we change the way we organize, you know, research techs, graduate students, postdocs, PIs, even within the laboratory itself, to better utilize kind of funds and kind of personnel resources?
Well, I guess there's a lot of discussion here on our campus about kind of dissolving independent labs and forming more integrated groups of laboratories now that are kind of fused together to accomplish common goals in research, of which a lot of that exists anyway. I mean, even in my department, I have a grant to study a genetic disease, and Paulo Dias has another grant to study the same disease. And, you know, we communicate and collaborate quite a bit, but we're not working in the same lab on the same project. So restructuring away from the individual investigator with his own set of graduate students and his own postdocs and his own technicians, and kind of fusing areas of common interest between investigators, so where there'd be a pool of postdocs and a pool of graduate students that are more or less working on a common goal, is one way I think that things could change, or that's being proposed as altering the structure of laboratory science, or how its personnel is are handled. And I think that, well, once again, drawing upon the experiences that I, what I witnessed in Dallas, that I think the Brown and Goldstein as a unit themselves, not just the two of them, are much stronger and much more productive than each one of them independently, even if they were working together. In other words, the sum of the parts is less than the aggregate in that case. And I think that can be applied in a lot of cases to investigators. And I'd like to, personally would like to get into that sort of relationship. And I'm trying, and then I have a very strong collaboration with a fine investigator here, that he and I work very closely together on one particular project in my research realm. And we do a good job of it, I think. And we go forward, I think, much quicker than we would if he was doing something on his own and I was doing something on my own and we just talked on the phone. So it seems that if we had more people, and that's once again gets away from, now this is not fusing labs together, it's just saying that you and I make a commitment that you and I are going to study this one project together. And that we're going to talk about experiments together, and we're going to share technicians, or a technician, or a postdoc. And we're going to have a joint grant, not a principal investigator and a co-investigator, but really two principal investigators on this grant, and share the expense. But I think that, and then we're able to bounce ideas off each other and criticize each other's thoughts and interpretations in a meaningful fashion without egos getting into it and all this, that, and the other, which, you know, I realize it's pretty difficult. But I think that we can really go, if more of us did something like that, at least on a partial to part-time basis, like Rod Bronson and I do now, that we will go, our profession will advance better, advance quicker. So that, once again, kind of breaks down those walls between individual departments in which occasionally you'll talk to a colleague at a meeting or on the phone or whatever. So it's more unifying than just calling it a collaboration in which I'm doing an experiment here and then he's doing an experiment here and then we just communicate. I mean, we're actually doing these things together.
Okay. Let me pause the tape for a second.
All right.
Okay. Well, we'll continue more with these questions tomorrow when we talk about your own kind of career, your funding career. But when we last talked about chronology, you had just started with DuPont. You had left the Brown and Goldstein lab and started with DuPont. And so were they making a better tomorrow through chemistry?
Well, they made a better tomorrow through chemistry. But I'm convinced of that. And they may make a better tomorrow through biology and biotechnology, but they're not going to do it at the rate that they thought they were. So what happened was that my read is that the amount of money that was needed to fulfill this commitment or to project the potential for this life science program to bring rewards to DuPont was much greater than what they anticipated. And maybe that coupled with the fact that their resources due to economic conditions were projected not to be as great as they originally thought. So the concept of having this freestanding institute began to crumble. the Institute didn't crumble, but just the idea is to go forward with it. Well, to maintain it. It was completed. The building was built. It was staffed. But to maintain it as a really just a freestanding institute funded by DuPont's money without any apparent return on that money became uncomfortable, or made the board of directors uncomfortable. So there were some changes in leadership that began to shift the focus from, say, 100% basic research to trying to incorporate some of the applied projects that were going on outside the walls, bring them inside the walls. And some of the last commitments that were to be made in completing this institution were dropped, financial commitments and resources. So that became apparent to me, or that was my conclusion, that it wasn't going to fulfill the expectations that I thought that was originally projected, and that it became conceivable that it would, that perhaps we would just become absorbed into the rest of the mainstream of DuPont, maybe not at the level of their chemical industry, but maybe in the form of a biotech company or whatever. So, and that didn't set well, because I felt like that would jeopardize my ability to fulfill some of the aspirations I had for myself in terms of being able to succeed as an independent investigator, and to, you know, make contributions on my own. That if I was going to, there would just be a limited amount of time and space and resources to do those things that I wanted to do. There'd be plenty of time and space to do things that somebody else wanted to do, but that, which could be interesting, but it wasn't exactly in my own aspirations at that time. So, and it was about that time that I realized that the only way that I could get into a somewhat secure situation to try and fulfill these aspirations was to become a principal investigator in a real academic institution, one that I had control over what I did, albeit through study sections and the like. But that seemed like it was a hard fact of the profession at the time. So that was the first, that gave me the first realization that it might be a good idea to get a PhD. Because if I was going to continue to pursue my goals, then this, it looked like that life science at DuPont was going to close the door on that. And if there weren't any other DuPonts opening up life science categories around, so the only place to do that would be at an academic institution or basic science research institution or whatever. And in order to do that, you had a PhD. So I began to look into that. And so I looked at, I really didn't think about going back to Texas. Not that I wouldn't want to, but just I thought that it wouldn't be appropriate to go back down to Southwestern. I did look at University of Texas in Austin. I wrote off recent information. I never did apply. And then I also looked into a PhD program at the University of Delaware, because that was close to Wilmington. And then there were some financial rewards from incentive from DuPont, you know, to do that. But the real The real, I guess, better in situation arose here at Tufts, and that came about primarily because I developed a relationship with a former postdoc in Dallas, Laura Liskum, who had recently become an assistant professor in the Department of Physiology here. And so I was familiar with the structure of this faculty through some social interactions. And they were familiar with me. And then the chairman, when Erwin Arias, was included in that group, that circle. So when I approached them about possibly getting a PhD in their department, then they were very enthusiastic and excited and glad to have me consider it, even to the point that they gave me a lot of encouragement and even lowered some of the academic requirements that had to be met, which was something that I thought would be really great if I could get some credit for, you know, experience on the job training. And so they all were very supportive of that. It was a program that kind of set it within the context of the Sackler School. It set its own requirements, as is all the programs in the Sackler School. So we all don't have the same number of didactic courses that students have to take. And then, of course, a PhD dissertation is as different between programs as it is within laboratories sometimes. So, and then I knew the people here. And then one of these little tangents that I was working on was something that Laura had picked up on. So we were scientifically collaborating on that. And it was going very well. So it was appealing to come here and go off and spend time on my own PhD research or whatever I want to do, but at the same time be able to intellectually participate in her project and also experimentally participate. So all the things were just right for me to come to Tufts as opposed to these other places, in spite of the fact that it was in Boston. I've grown to like it.
Okay.
So it was just one of those things that if I wanted to continue to follow the trail that I aspired to go on, that this was the best way to do it, was to go to Tufts Physiology for a graduate degree. It was the fastest, it was the cheapest, it was potentially the most rewarding and satisfying and intellectually stimulating. So that was a no-brainer too, just like the difference between DuPont versus Upjohn and Merck. And once again, as I was with falling into the hands of Joe and Mike, it's been very fortunate to be in this department because they're very supportive and they've helped me enormously. The doors they open are a little bit easier to walk through.
Why is that?
Well, they're just, I fit into those rooms a little bit better. They're not that maybe it's got something to do with the size of the doors or the people that are in the rooms. I don't know. But I've never felt uncomfortable fulfilling their expectations or trying to do that.
Okay, let me flip this over.
Uh-huh.